that confidence of Lakeland?
I'm more confident today, Tony, because he is here. I know James J. Dillon, Barry Windham, Ric Flair are here. I want everybody out there to know, if you're not sure somebody's watching the Superstation, call them. Tell them to turn it over. They're going to see the biggest shock and the biggest surprise of their life today.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is advised for the following professional wrestling exhibition.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Championship Wrestling, bringing you great wrestling action sanctioned by the NWA, the National Wrestling Alliance.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 153 of Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winston. And today, I'm going to go back 31 years this month to January 21st, 1989 for some good old-fashioned World Championship Wrestling action on Saturday night. Taking a look at the NWA as it rolls into 1989, now under the Turner regime, the first full year of that. And there's a very big event occurs on this show. I often talk about, what was the hook of the show that I'm doing? And it'd usually be something like a feature bout or an angle. And we got a real big one on this show. But before I get into all that, why don't I get my plugs? You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com. Facebook.com/GreetingsFromAllentown. Give me a follow on Twitter at GF Allentown Pod. That is at GF Allentown Pod. And you may be listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. And do check out all the other great shows on the Pro Wrestling Only Network. I always forget to do this every single time. And you can listen to Greetings from Allentown, however you're listening to it right now. Because you are, if you're hearing the sound of my voice. But the show is available on Spotify. Now, I don't know how you go in and you listen to Spotify. I know people subscribe to it for music and whatnot, but apparently they added podcasts, and I submitted it about 4 or 5 months ago, I want to say, and then I completely forgot about it. And then on a weekly basis, every week, I swear to God, I'm like banging my fist on the table because I'm so mad about this every week. I forget to say, oh yeah, you can listen to this podcast on Spotify. So do check that out because they sent me statistics for my show on Spotify for the year 2019. And I was very amused by one particular thing, which was the gender breakdown of the audience, which was 99% male, 0% female, and 1% undecided. I don't know how that works out. I guess if you don't fill out the profile thing or whatever. But I did get a kick out of that. And it kind of goes back to my I would like to be the most listened to female by females podcast in pro wrestling. However, there are plenty of females who host pro wrestling podcasts. So I'm probably not going to get into that demographic. I mean, you know, yeah, I like to have a lot of people listening, but it's, you know, I'm not obsessed over it, especially like I was in the beginning where, you know, you're really trying to build to something. But anyway, I'm fairly comfortable where I am now. And it did help that I ended up on Pro Wrestling Only and then became associated with the Place to Be Nation Network. And speaking of which, talk about Royal Rumble Sunday, because I was down at the house of one JT Rosero down in Rhode Island, but Sunday was a very, very odd day for a number of different reasons. Because for me to get down to Rhode Island, it's a couple of hours. So it's a long drive, and I figure, well, why don't I create a stopping point first? Why don't I stop at the Plain Ridge Park Casino in Massachusetts, which everybody talks about the big casino that was built near Boston, the Encore, which was going to be called the Wynn Casino, but then Steve Wynn got into trouble for various sexual harassment things. Plain Ridge Park is not as big as that one, not as big as the MGM one out in Springfield, but I like going there because I went in September and I won $65. It was on like a Wednesday afternoon and I was on my way down to the Cape to buy quahogs. So I figure, well, why don't I stop in there on my way to Rhode Island? It's a little bit more than halfway, you know, maybe even win some money. Well, that didn't happen because I go in there, and this was about 3:45, 4 o'clock. And I said, okay, well, if I'm going to go down and sit down and play blackjack at one of the machines or video poker, I'm going to need a coffee. So as I get in the Dunkin' Donuts line, which is like barely moving, I look down at my phone and I get one of those Washington Post alerts, and it says Kobe Bryant killed in a helicopter crash. And I don't know how that, like, it always, whenever somebody dies really young like that, it kind of hits you in a certain way. Maybe it's the, oh, you remember where you were when this happened. I certainly recall where I was when Reggie Lewis of the Boston Celtics died. I was got back to the hotel after a day at Disney World and found out that the best player on my favorite team had died. Kobe hasn't been active for about 3 or 4 years, but of course he's very beloved in the basketball community at large. I mean, that's the number one thing that I've noticed out of all of this is, you know, I'm not a huge basketball guy, but it's something that I've noticed, and I wouldn't have guessed the amount of influence that he had. And I'll just, you know, reiterate the point that I was trying to make, probably inartfully, on the Place to Be podcast on Monday night, where we covered the April 1990 Saturday Night's Main Event. Kobe is always going to be compared with Michael Jordan, which might not be fair to Kobe because Michael Jordan is kind of put up in this pantheon, you know, God among men, all that sort of stuff. The thing that I think sets Kobe apart is he's very, very human for a guy at that level. Like, you don't think of the humanity of Larry Bird or Michael Jordan all that much. But Kobe had his foibles through the years. He feuds with Shaq. He had the thing in Colorado, you know, whatever the hell that was. And you got the thing in 2007 where he demanded to be traded from the Lakers. I mean, he almost ended up a member of the Chicago Bulls, as I remember. But instead, he wins MVP that year. So it was always the way that he would kind of, these things would happen, and he would learn from them, and he would grow as a human being, which I think is part of the reason why, as he got late into his career and in retirement, he became such a beloved figure. And I had absolutely no intention of talking this much about Kobe Bryant, but all I know is I was a little, you know, it's just kind of a weird thing to hit you. And that's the reason why I lost $96 playing blackjack. It was not the fact that I was getting poor cards. It was the fact that I was completely distracted. And, well, yeah, I was also making some, you know, bad bets too, because I was jumping around in my betting number, and I should have just walked out of there with the $40 left and ended up only losing 60. But that's the way the ball bounces. But on my way down to Rhode Island, now if you've listened to the Place to Be Nation shows, and in fact the ad used to play in the middle of this program when PWO was associated with Place to Be Nation, I still play the thing at the top because, well, you know, I'm still a member of the family over there. Bonehead's Wing Bar and Grill in West Warwick, Rhode Island. And I finally had the pleasure of having Bonehead wings. And they were pretty damn good. The thing that I was most impressed about, the actual meat on the wings was extremely well cooked. Now, I prefer a dry wing, particularly Old Bay seasoning. They put a lot of Old Bay seasoning on there. But here's the thing about that. You can put, like, as much Old Bay, you can put 3 pounds of Old Bay seasoning on something, and it really doesn't make a difference. It doesn't hurt it, like, if you're putting that was something much more salt-based, I guess. It's not going to hurt the product. So, have some good wings, good times down there. About a dozen of the guys down at Rosero's house in Rhode Island. It's about an hour and 40 minutes, I'd say, from where I live, which meant, well, knowing that the Royal Rumble is a late event, and I had a fear that it was going to go to midnight. As it turns out, it went to about 11:10, and I left right before Asuka versus Becky Lynch, thinking, okay, well, I'll see if I can get home for the very end. This means I'll get home about 11, and sure enough, when I turned on the TV, when I came in, Seth Rollins was in the ring, and I was like, oh, God, he's not going to win this, is he? But I went back and watched the Men's Rumble the next morning, or actually on Monday when I got home from work, and I was way more delighted by the whole Brock Lesnar thing than I ever thought I would be. Particularly the New Day interaction with him. Kind of wish that Big E had gotten a little bit more shine in there, but kind of saving some of that for Keith Lee. Because I had actually paused it when Keith Lee and Brock Lesnar were in there, like, facing off. You know, like, I can't. I just can't. Like, I became, like, this dainty southern dandy or something like that. These two hosses in the middle of the ring. Glad it was Keith Lee and not Matt Riddle. Which, by the way, I love how they have, like, the backstage confrontation. Like, oh, how convenient is that? And then Matt Riddle gets eliminated in about 22 seconds when he gets out there. So, a pretty decent show. I'm not so keen on Fiend Bray Wyatt and that whole character. But, as it looks like I'm not going to WrestleMania in Tampa. But I can hold my head high because SummerSlam will be in Boston at TD Garden. Now, to World Championship Wrestling in January of 1989. And to go back to my talking point from a couple of weeks ago, yes, WCW going through some changes. The Turner buyout, but I talked about that about a dozen episodes ago. I think it was only 7 or 8 episodes ago. The November of 1988 show. So it's really World Championship Wrestling after the Turner buyout. But you can still call it the NWA because they're part of the NWA and it's basically almost the entire entity. Who's in charge at this point? Well, Jim Crockett is still around. I don't know if you'd say he was in charge, but the booker at this point is George Scott, which makes sense given who we're going to see the return of on this show. But George Scott's tenure was a disaster in many ways. With the most, the famous part of it is when they get to Clash of the Champions 6 and you get your main event of Ric Flair versus Ricky the Dragon Steamboat. Oh, spoiler, yes, of course. He's the one who returns on this show. It's a disaster because George Scott didn't want to promote it because he thought it would hurt the house show business. Never mind that the house show business was not exactly being set on fire by this, but it's definitely a classic case of a guy who did not understand what modern wrestling, where everything was trending. Dusty Rhodes, what's he doing? Well, he's out as of January 21st. January 14th, that weekend of TV, so the weekend before this, that is his last weekend, and he is gone. He goes down to Florida for a little while, working in the PWF, a promotion that I covered back in episode 94. So it sounds like, okay, well, is there any actual good stuff going on? Well, Ricky the Dragon Steamboat is coming back to challenge Ric Flair. I mean, what the hell more do you need than that? But you got Eddie Gilbert, who's the plucky underdog babyface, trying to, you know, line up by himself against the Four Horsemen. And we see clips of the previous week's TV. This is something that was built to, I think, very, very well. But at the same time, the Four Horsemen, who are completely dominant for much of 1988, where you got the tag champs Arn and Tully, they split in September. Barry Windham, U.S. champion, he holds that title up to the Chi-Town Rumble in February of 89. And Flair, of course, is the world champion for the entire calendar year of 1988. But it seems to be coming apart a little because of Arn and Tully not being there. And even J.J. Dillon is on the way out looking for, you know, greener pastures. And that would come in the WWF. His tenure ends on February 5th. He basically gets replaced by Hiro Matsuda as sort of the manager of the skeletal remains of the Four Horsemen. Butch Reed returns to the NWA, for whatever the hell that's worth. His first match back is actually on this program. I actually covered his first match in the World Wrestling Federation way, way, way back in, I believe it was the first episode that I did, was Butch Reed's first match. And, of course, one of my favorite NWA things from this time period. No, you thought I was going to stay Rick Steiner in the TV title? Of course, I've spoken about that ad nauseum. No, the original Midnight Express and the regular Midnight Express, the Jim Cornette version. That feud is still going on. Yes, it gets screwed up at the end at the Chi-Town Rumble, where you get substitutions in a loser-leave-town match, but I'm not going to let that affect my enjoyment of it. The same way I'm not going to let certain things in Royal Rumbles, like the fact that person comes into the ring and runs wild for 40 seconds, I guess is the Scott Keith terminology, kind of hits big moves on a couple of people. It's kind of been that way forever. So I made myself feel better about the fact, like, oh yeah, they were doing that in 1992. So that means it's okay. So without any further ado, I've done more than enough talking leading up to this. 1989 WCW is always a good take, even though I have not covered this part of the year. And I am a little worried because when you look at some of the matches on here, it's not exactly, we don't have a lot of super workers on this show. We got Michael Hayes, but it's Michael Hayes by his lonesome, and he's taking on one of the Russian assassins. Butch Reed, that's an enhancement match. We see the Varsity Club in the form of Mike Rotunda and Kevin Sullivan. Dr. Death is not really on the scene at this point because I believe he is in Japan in January of 1989. But really, this is kind of the definition of a one-match show for a one-hour wrestling program where Eddie Gilbert has a mystery partner that he's going to unveil against the team of Barry Windham and Ric Flair. So you got, on the other side, the world champion and the U.S. champion. And Eddie Gilbert, as I said, a plucky babyface underdog, which you wish we had gotten more of that as time went along. Yes, he's very creative. And Eddie Gilbert did a lot of great things in his career. Just thinking back to in the UWF, where he buried Bill Watts in the flag. To me, he's one of the most fascinating figures in wrestling history just because of how creative he was and all the various things that he could do as a performer. Was he a big guy? No. But considering he passed away very young, I think he was 33 years old in 1995 when he passed away. So just picture, you know, had he lived 97, 98, 99, you have to think, just given, you know, the wealth of talent in his mind, he ends up in WCW or the WWF at some point. I mean, you think of Eddie Gilbert in the Attitude Era. Oh, he certainly fits in seamlessly. But I also think if you threw him into WCW in 1999, at least he would create like a watchable segment or two compared with the dreck that they were running out there. So his passing in 95 is definitely a huge tragedy for the wrestling business. So, without any further ado, WCW World Championship Wrestling, the Saturday edition for January 21, 1989.
Hi, everybody. This is World Championship Wrestling. Cody Schiavone and Jim Ross ringside with the NWA, the Major League of Professional Wrestling.
Very interesting of Tony Schiavone to call it the Major League of Professional Wrestling, since he too is about to go out the door. He's only got one more Saturday show after this, so he's calling this the Major League of Professional Wrestling, even though he's going to be on the other side of the world shortly. He's co-hosting here with Jim Ross. It's interesting, I was looking up, when did he start with the WWF? And I had it in my head, he was there before WrestleMania 5. Because he does the show at MSG with the cage match with Hogan and Boss Man, which he called the favorite match that he has ever announced on his podcast a couple of years ago. But there's a listing on historywwe.com. Probably should have reached out to Richard Land about this, because I think I found a mistake. But I don't want to be like that guy who's pointing out these little minute errors. Because it says that Tony Schiavone and Lord Alfred Hayes called the Cops Coliseum show on January 16th. I have not found any evidence that Tony and Lord Al are calling that show. In fact, I saw matches from that somewhere else, and it's Rod Tronkard and Superstar Billy Graham. So calling back to 1988, maybe they did stuff that was dubbed over for International Challenge. I'm not entirely sure, but I got to defend Tony Schiavone, because it's not like he started f***ing the new girlfriend before he was done f***ing the old girlfriend. Obviously, Tony is something of a family man, but it's interesting because this is a 5.5-year run in the NWA, most of it with Crockett all the way up to the buyout. And you think, oh, in 83, you see him on TV, and it's basically like they plucked him out of his first communion, or maybe his confirmation, or something, boyish looks to him. And now all of a sudden he has to go to the WWF. He's got his mustache, but he's going to shave that off because they won't allow two interview guys with mustaches. So out on the scene, we got Eddie Gilbert, who had been jumped by Ric Flair in his match with Barry Windham the previous week. Barry actually, we're going to see a clip from it a little bit later on. Windham superplexes Eddie Gilbert, but does that thing where I don't really feel like pinning him because I'm just going to punish him a little bit more. This is just a little glimpse into one facet of what Eddie Gilbert could have been, the underdog babyface who's fighting, you know, the heel faction, and is just kind of raising hell and stirring the pot with them and doing things to get one over on them as he would on this particular show. So he's out there, he's wearing a very nice sweater. I don't know why I'm so like obsessed with like what he's wearing, but he's going to be facing Flair and Windham. His mystery partner is here, and he's got instructions for the viewing audience.
I'm more proud today, Tony, because he is here. I know James J. Dillon, Barry Windham, Ric Flair are here. I want everybody out there to know, if you're not sure somebody's watching the Superstation, call them. Tell them to turn it over. They're going to see the biggest shock and the biggest surprise of their life today.
That is a real attention-getting statement. Like, call your friends and tell them to turn on the Superstation right now. But you better be correct, and you better have something big in store, because you don't want to be the person who tells somebody, oh, yeah, call up your friends and tell them what's coming up. And then Eddie Gilbert brings out 2020 Kane or something like that as like his big surprise. So you have to deliver. And of course, he would do so in spades. Now, up first, our opening match is Freebird Michael Hayes taking on Russian Assassin number 2. I don't know why this matchup amuses me so much. Like, the guy with the Confederate flag facing the Soviet, like, okay. Clearly we have enemies of America facing off here, I guess, if you want to take it back to the Civil War. But Michael Hayes, he returned to the NWA at the start of 1989. I was trying to figure out the timing on it, because I'm like, he's not there at Starrcade. You'd think if Michael Hayes is there, he would have been used in some form or fashion there, but he obviously isn't. But at the end of 1988, he bounced all over the place in a way that was even pretty manic for somebody around that time, with fewer territories running by that point in the 80s. He's going between World Class, Memphis, and the AWA. However, it sounds less impressive when you realize that they're all linked by the Super Clash 3 pay-per-view, so there was some coordination going on between those three territories. I say some, because once Super Clash happened, that pretty much came to an end. Hayes teamed with Steve Cox at Super Clash 3, losing to the Samoan SWAT team. It's quite a drop-off from Terry Gordy and even Buddy Roberts, and hell, I'll even say it's a drop-off from Jimmy Garvin and what is to come. Now, Russian Assassin number 2, the Russian Assassins are undermasked. The number 1 is the Angel of Death, Dave Sheldon. Russian Assassin number 2, I don't know why I have such trouble saying it, is my good pal Jack Victory, who I hated a lot in 1998 ECW. But I'm going to put that aside. Just let you know, this guy was Wrestling Observer Newsletter Rookie of the Year for the year 1985. Which I guess means something, but it's kind of weird to think of Jack Victory as like this hero to smart fans. There's kind of a disconnect, but maybe 85 was a slow year for that sort of thing. I don't really know. But he's kind of like the Steve Lyons of the NWA, which I know nobody will get unless you're a baseball fan from the 80s. Steve Lyons is an announcer now. I know he's been on the Fox, but back in the 80s, he was this super utility player for the Red Sox and the White Sox who would play. I know there was one game where he played all 9 positions on the field over the course of the 9 innings. How does this tie back to Jack Victory? Well, he became famous in 1989 for playing every single masked guy. If they needed somebody on like a Clash of Champions to don a mask and face Lex Luger or somebody else, Jack Victory was your man for the job. He plays the blackmailer, the upcoming Clash 5. He plays the terrorist to great effect at Clash 7 on an army base, no less, against Ranger Ross. I love that match so much. He plays Russian Assassin number 2, obviously, and the Super Destroyer on Clash of the Champions 9 towards the end of the year. And, oh yeah, along the way, at the Chi-Town Rumble in February, he fills in for Dennis Condrey in the Midnight Express when Dennis Condrey is basically like, F you and your pay-per-view payout, I'm out of here, and becomes a member of the Midnight Express for one night. Back to Hayes. Gordy is not there. Jimmy Garvin isn't there because he's still selling that injury from Kevin Sullivan in the Varsity Club the previous summer. And for whatever reason, it's like 1982 world class. There's that period when Hayes shows up for about 4 weeks or so, and before Gordy and the rest and Roberts show up. And I was thinking about Michael Hayes on my way home from work, which is just a horrifying statement. Like, if you go back to, like, when I was, I don't know, 12 years old, say, you know, on this day, like, 28 years from now, you're going to be thinking about Michael Hayes for, like, 12 minutes on your way home from work. And I'm just thinking, what is wrong with me? And honestly, I was just thinking about how, yes, the Freebirds, legendary act. Hayes' career peaked very, very early with the Freebirds because he's really not much of a wrestler after, you know, an in-ring guy after about 1992. And that's fine. You know, some people will peak earlier than others. Other guys will be late bloomers. But Michael Hayes, he becomes Doc Hendricks later on because WWF wants to kind of distance themselves from all that and then eventually goes back to being Michael Hayes. I'm like, what movie character is Michael Hayes most like in history? And then it hit me that Michael Hayes is Stifler from the American Pie movies, where you watch that first one, and Sean, the character played by Sean William Scott, he's very, very funny. You're like, oh, he's a real cut-up. Oh, boy, I'd love to hang out with that guy. Then you get to American Pie 2, and you start to think, maybe he's a little bit immature. You know, you're a couple years older now, Stifler. Maybe you should grow up, you know, along with the rest of them. Michael Hayes, kind of the same way, where he kind of feels like stuck in a moment in time. And then when you get to, like, American Reunion, the 2003 movie, you basically want somebody to assassinate Stifler from off screen, and that's kind of where Michael Hayes and the Freebirds are in 91 and 92 when you got Big Daddy Dink and DDP is hanging out with them. They're basically like Stifler in American Reunion. And yes, this is what I actually thought about on my drive home from work today, and this is what happens when you work an hour away from where you live. Paul Jones is there with the Russian Assassins. One is also outside the ring. He's still there. I know I complained in that earlier episode about why didn't he lose the Loser Leave Town match at Starrcade 88? Because he leaves in 2 months anyway. You could have, like, made the crowd happy or whatever, but yet he's still there for whatever reason. I don't hate him or anything. He's perfectly fine, I guess, as a promo, but he'd just been there for so long at this point, and the times they are a-changing. As Tony points out that we got a real styles clash because number two is from Russia. And I'm so happy listening to Tony here because he could easily just be mailing it in and not giving a crap at all because he knows that better days are ahead for him. But even he's making up stuff like Jack Victory under that mask is really a Russian. As you get a wrist lock by Assassin number two, and Hayes just kind of kicks his way out of it. As Hayes then goes ahead and works the left arm, as they discuss JR and Tony, the show in Kansas City that night, which, in looking at it, drew, it was at the Municipal Auditorium, drew 4684, which, for whatever reason, feels like a pretty good crowd for WCW and NWA around that time for that kind of venue. Here's just a little taste of what was going on that night. Steve Casey defeated Al Perez, Seth Rollins' father, by disqualification. Abdul the Butcher defeated Gary Royal. Sting and Rick Steiner defeated Steve Williams and Mike Rotunda. So I guess Steve Williams wasn't in Japan. I guess I must have just been projecting that. Barry Windham pinned Eddie Gilbert. Lex Luger, Michael Hayes, and Dick Murdoch. What a team that is. defeated the Road Warriors and Paul Ellering. Gee, I wonder who took the pin in that one. Ric Flair to pin the Junkyard Dog in 1820. Junkyard Dog going 1820 in the year of our Lord, 1989. And then finally, guests doing double duty, a lot of the guys, Rick Steiner won a Bunkhouse Battle Royal, but probably only because Dusty Rhodes was not there. These two guys, Hayes and Victory, they're just laying down in an arm bar. Like, we're getting a lot of that. Hayes did end up at one side, outside at one point, and Russian Assassin number one gets in a shot on him. I should just call him one and two, because it feels cumbersome to actually say Russian Assassin, and it's like a she sells seashells by the seashore type situation. A back elbow off an Irish whip by Hayes, but then he misses an elbow drop, and then we're right back to the same freaking armbar, lazy 1980s style armbar. But then finally, Hayes fires up. Assassin 2, he misses a charge, but then Russian Assassin grabs the legs and, using the ropes, not putting his feet up on it, but kind of holding onto it for leverage, a la Honky Tonk Man against Ricky Steamboat. However, our intrepid official, Theodore Long, he's going by Teddy at this point, he stops the count, but Paul Jones, like an idiot, gets up on the apron and puts like a fist in the air like he's won. So they think they've won the match, and Michael Hayes takes advantage and rolls up Russian Assassin number two for the victory. This was just boring as shit. I mean, I would say about 71% of this match was laying around in a 1980s style armbar. But it's nice to see Stifler picking up a win while his friends aren't around. When they come back from the commercial break, Tony Schiavone, I'm going to say, is putting Howard Finkel on notice because he's reading the next 2 weeks of NWA house shows coming up. I say he's putting Finkel on notice because you'd see that on Primetime Wrestling, the one with the little airplane flying through, and then Finkel would tell you that Hacksaw Jim Duggan was coming to the Jaffa Mosque in Altoona, Pennsylvania. And Schiavone's kind of doing the same thing here. One more thing I want to throw out there about the Kansas City Auditorium that I forgot to mention for the show that night. It actually hosted three of the first four Final Four tournaments in NCAA basketball from 1940 to 1942. Clearly a much smaller enterprise back then. It was actually the second, third, and fourth Final Fours. So up next, we have Butch Reed back in the NWA after a bit of a hiatus from wrestling. I don't think he was doing a whole lot for most of 1988 because he leaves the WWF right after WrestleMania 4. In fact, I think the match with Savage in the tournament is the last match he actually does. I think there was stuff that was taped prior that aired after on something like a Primetime Wrestling. And he's back to having the dark hair. So no more of that blonde stuff and calling himself the Natural. He's taking on George South, if I didn't mention this. I guess we'll call him George Mid-South to make Butch Reed more comfortable, the old territory that he was in. And he's with J.J. Dillon, Reed is. But this is only for 2 weeks. I was kind of scratching my head, like, okay, Dillon's going to be out the door soon. And why is this, they ask Tony and JR. Well, I guess it's only speculation as to where that might be leading. Guess what, though? Jim Ross is going to say something about Butch Reed. It's so hard to believe that Jim Ross brings up Butch Reed playing football. I can't believe it.
Reed blatantly pulled the hair. He's one of those powerful athletes in the sport today, is this man. Junior college football All-American as a linebacker. Also an NAI All-American. Played for the Kansas City Chiefs. He was a headhunter on the gridiron, and he is a headhunter here in the squared circle.
Even though I majored in journalism, I'm not going to call myself an investigative reporter because I'm going to look into whether Butch Reed actually played for the Kansas City Chiefs. And I sent a text to my friend in Kansas City who might remember something from the late 70s. Might not, though, because, you know, drugs were kind of big back then. Like I said, everybody was on drugs in the 70s, so it's very hard for people to remember. And maybe it's the same for Jim Ross, because I looked up a Kansas City Chiefs lifetime roster, and there's no Bruce Reed, which is Butch Reed's real name, on there. However, I know records can be a little bit spotty once before a certain point, especially for non-skill position guys. And they're saying, oh, well, he's more of like a special teamer, is what I was reading. But like the citation for, oh, Bruce Reed played for the Kansas City Chiefs, is either from WWE.com, which I'm not sure I'm going to totally buy, because, you know, they mix in a healthy dose of fact and fiction. And Animal's book, I guess, that he wrote. And then one other thing that I kind of question. But, yeah, he may have played for the Kansas City Chiefs for 1 year. I mean, I'm not going to look into it too much. But all I know is I'm going to keep a healthy dose of skepticism when Jim Ross weaves these tales of football past. With that being said, when he talks about Brian Pillman and the Cincinnati Bengals and him winning, you know, a special teamer award for his gritty play on the football field, that was actually true. But it's a lot easier to tie back with that because it was like 1984 when that happened, whereas Bruce Reed might have been on the 1977 Kansas City Chiefs, and who really knows. His offense is nothing dynamic here. Although apparently, maybe he picked something up from Ted DiBiase, since they've been in the same place for a lot of the time that he's been a professional wrestler. The kind of falling fist drop, very DiBiase-like. Teddy Long, once again, the referee. Apparently, he's the only guy on hand. But we get a nice little Doom prequel with Butch Reed, who has this run, and then eventually, it's so comical in the NWA, where you basically had three persons of color. You had Ranger Ross, Ron Simmons, and Butch Reed. And then Ranger Ross is still there, but the other two guys, they disappear. Like, where did they go? All of a sudden, these two masked men who appear to be of African-American descent now all of a sudden have appeared. Like, who are these strangers? And then you still got Jim Ross reeling off their football career, even when they're masked. I think it was actually the match that they were about to get unmasked by the Steiners, but still kind of funny. A shoulder tackle, Reed heads up top. His finisher is the clothesline off the top rope, which I guess might be a cool move for the 80s, but come on, we're in 1989. I mean, we're nearing the end. I mean, IRS is going to be using this as a finisher in a few years, if that's a signal of where everything is going. Hey, speaking of the future IRS, he's up next.
Steiner, you moron. I just gave you a taste right here in this ring of what's to come. I gave you a pile driver, pal, and made you a little shorter than you already are. And it's just a matter of time before that TV title is right back where it belongs. Because I earned it, I own it, and I own you now, Steiner. The day is coming real soon.
A few weeks ago, somebody directed my attention on Twitter, posting a clip of a Mike Rotundo promo from very early in his career. So it was before even that 83 show that I covered several weeks back. Something like 1981, and he's so dull and like tripping over himself. So it takes a little while to find yourself in the professional wrestling business. Now, I'll grant you, the U.S. Express in the WWF, when he's teaming with Barry Windham, his brother-in-law, he's just carrying a flag, so I think he's popular in mainly because he's carrying a U.S. flag in the year 1985. But it is good to see. 1988, he finally figures it out. What character can I be? And not to bring it back to movie characters again, but he's Stan Gable from Revenge of the Nerds. Except, well, I don't really see the Mike Rotundo getting laid, and that's not really anything I want to picture. Now, Kevin Sullivan, on the other hand, my lovable proxy for the NCAA as part of the varsity club, although they are going to wind down as we get a little bit into 1989, he's going to get over a minute of speaking time here. And again, I try to take steps here to conceal my Boston accent at least a little bit. I catch myself saying Sergeant Slaughter and all that. But the thing that I respect about Kevin Sullivan is, here's a guy who worked in like the Southeast for much of his career. He was not working the Boston territory, as it were. But this is a man who made sure that he never forgot where he came from in terms of how he talks.
Obviously, the Road Warriors are still the favorites. And they're the guys that people say they're fierce. Aren't you afraid of them? They left me a long time ago when I was strapped to the tree of woe for 6 days and 6 nights. fear left me when they sent me to the sweat box for 4 days and four nights. Road Warriors, the only time I've ever gone into a bar and seen guys with makeup on their faces when I took a wrong turn and went to the wrong bar. You may be the fiercest bullies of the block. You may be fearsome, and you may be the toughest around. That was until the Varsity Club came about. You see, Dr. Death, Kevin Sullivan, you always say you dine on danger and snack on death. That's right. You're going to snack on death all night long because the doctor is going to deliver it. And right here is danger. And danger is this. Hawk, I'm singling you out, and I'm going to reach down in your throat, Hawk, and I'm going to pluck out your heart. You ain't so fearsome to me.
Wow, what a promo that was. I'm not going to forgive the fact that he got it backwards, because I think the line is snack on danger and dine on death rather than dine on danger and snack on death. I really feel like death is really more of like a full meal, so that's something you'd want to dine on rather than, you know, it's not really sort of an appetizer. But the accent in that promo is so amazing. Now, when you take the content of what Kevin Sullivan is saying, you could probably call me out and be like, hey, Winston, you're the one ripping the Ultimate Warrior because his promos don't really make a whole lot of sense. Well, first of all, Kevin Sullivan is not snorting through his promos and annoying me in that way. But the bottom line to all of that is, in that comparison, is if the Ultimate Warrior spoke in a Boston accent, he would have become my favorite wrestler of all time, because I would have been able to tolerate it, because it's just something I hear on a regular basis. The Varsity Club, Sullivan and Dr. Death. Now, where the hell did I get this Dr. Death was in Japan? I mean, they didn't want him there because he got busted for drugs the year before. But they're challenging the Road Warriors for the tag team titles at the Chi-Town Rumble, unsuccessfully, I might add. Around the time the Road Warriors, they're kind of given up on that little heel run, which I guess they couldn't take Animal doing good fired up promos, so they just changed them right back. So we get Rotundo and Sullivan. They're in there against Gene Miller and Randy Hogan. It doesn't really matter. And Randy Hogan is that guy who was bald with the blonde hair and the Fu Manchu mustache named Hogan. I don't know what his deal is, but Sullivan works him over. We get a lot of arm work with hammer locks and so forth. I guess they're good technical mat technicians, the two Varsity Club guys, as JR and Tony talk about Abdul the Butcher coming in as a Road Warrior partner, perhaps, down the road. Although, it is strange to me because I was scratching my head. I'm like, isn't Tenryu the six-man champion? And then right afterwards, like, literally the next sentence, they're like, oh yeah, Tenryu is the six-man champion. I don't know where they were going with that. Get a tag out to Miller as Sullivan just kind of smacks him around. Kevin, he's referred to what I think of him first as the Taskmaster, which, like, he's very good at organizing things and getting them done. But back in 89, he's being called the Games Master. Now, I don't know if that has to do with the Varsity Club and, you know, these guys are athletes and they play games, or like the Games Master. What is he, like the 1988 Chutes and Ladders World Champion? Oh yeah, he's very good at playing sorry. It's the Games Master. I haven't played a board game in a while. I kind of miss those a little bit. So JR raises a question about Mike Rotundo, and I don't know why I'm going to field this talking point.
I think that through Sullivan's so-called leadership, that Rotundo is almost obsessed in winning that TV championship back. Many people say that Rotundo was the greatest television champion ever in the NWA. And Tony, we certainly cannot disagree with that.
But he's using the phrase, many people are saying this, like, who? Who is saying that Mike Rotundo is the greatest TV champion of all time? It's like, should I bring in Keithy to do, like, Trump impersonation that he likes to do? Like, many people are saying this, failing New York Times. I mean, who is saying that Mike Rotundo, like, where are these conversations taking place? But, okay. All right, I'm game. Is he the greatest TV champion of all time? Well, let's look at some of the other names. Tully Blanchard, Nikita Koloff, who actually lost the title to Rotundo early in 1988, which I covered tangentially on a show from February 6th, 1988 as well. Arn Anderson, Dusty Rhodes. I don't know. These are some big names we're talking about here, but okay, let's look at it a different way. It was a long title reign for Rotundo, pretty much the entire calendar year of 1988, but did he add anything to the proceedings? Could he main event a house show? I call it, it's the Honky Tonk Man corollary, where like, yes, he said he was the greatest Intercontinental Champion of all time, in part, well, he started claiming that early on, but then his case mostly rested on, well, he held it longer than anybody else. Well, I don't know if that particularly, you know, speaks too much to it. I'm more interested in, could this guy main event a house show program like a Honky Tonk Man in 1987 and, you know, draw a halfway decent house, I guess. Did he get elevated by being the television champion? Now, he's going to win it back at the Chi-Town Rumble, which a lot of that, I think, is a function of Scott Steiner is going to be coming in, and you're going to want to pair him with Rick, and you got a natural tag team there, so you don't really need Rick in the singles division, so you might as well just go back to Rotundo. He's not the best television champion. I'm sorry. I've pretty much disproved it, because you're talking about the top of a card. If you want to put them at the top of a card, the more marquee names are Tully, Arn, and Dusty Rhodes. I'm sorry. It's just a ridiculous statement on its face, as we do get a tree of woe. I don't know how this is connected back to what Sullivan was saying, because he had mentioned tree of woe. And, you know, I just enjoyed listening to his voice quite a bit. Oh, boy. Kevin Sullivan, I'll just know. You know what? I should just watch like a 90-minute to 2-hour compilation tape of Kevin Sullivan promos, just back to back to back. And I want like the most Boston accent ones that he possibly could do. I'm not talking stuff where like, oh yeah, Kevin Sullivan's down in Florida in 1977. He's trying to conceal his Boston accent. Not interested in any of that. And he charges into Miller, just kind of freight trains him. And they're really torturing this guy. But Rotundo tags in, hits a classic-looking double underhook suplex. And finally, this match is over, and the Varsity Club is victorious.
Tony, you know, for 7 long days, I've waited till this moment to embarrass the Four Horsemen. Well, Ric Flair, you're the man that's come out here and said, to be the man, you must beat the man. And Barry Windham and Ric Flair and J.J. Dillon, I got a man that can beat all 3 of you with both hands tied behind his back in just a little bit, Tony. Just a little bit. And stay right where you are. That match coming up right after this timeout.
Maybe this is only with the benefit of hindsight, but seeing Eddie out there with this wry grin, you could tell that there's something definitely up his sleeve, just from the look on his face, and it's going to be something big. Like, alert your friends, call them up right now and tell them to turn on TBS. And they showed the lead-up video from the prior week with him getting jumped by Ric Flair during his match against Barry Windham. So the mystery guy is billed as Mr. X, which makes me laugh because when you say Mr. X, I mean, that's something that's been kind of used as a generic name across promotions. Though I think of Mr. X from the WWF from the mid-80s first, which would generally be Dangerous Danny Davis under a mask, which is shortly after this point in time that the WWF gave up on him as a wrestler and just made him a referee again on double secret probation or some such nonsense. It would have been funny if Dangerous Danny Davis was the guy that Eddie Gilbert brought in after all this buildup. Somehow I don't think that would have worked quite as well as what we ended up getting. As you see, Flair, Windham, and J.J. Dillon all in the ring. And Flair, he's yelling. He's wondering where Eddie Gilbert's partner is, because Eddie's in the ring as well. He comes out by himself, but then the music hits.
Where's his partner? Where's the big man, huh?
Well, the partner is not there with him right now, but he has a smile on his face, Jim Ross, it appears, and the confidence that he talked about, he knows that he's here. Gilbert looks very, very self-confident right now as we await the arrival of the mystery partner, Mr. X, and we hear the music in the background. that will bring to the ring Eddie Gilbert's mystery partner here, fans. Flair and Windham are anxiously awaiting the arrival of Eddie Gilbert's partner. And Tony, I don't believe what we're seeing here. Jim, that's Rick Steamboat. It's the Dragon. Ricky, the Dragon Steamboat, will be the partner of Hot Stuff Eddie Gilbert in this main event. Ric Flair, Barry Windham, in disbelief that Ricky, the Dragon Steamboat, has arrived.
I'm going to give JR and Tony credit for being patient on the call of this. By which I mean, you hear the music, you hear Sirius, and you associate it with Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, because while he's been in the WWF, people generally would associate that song with him in a wrestling context. Even though it's 1989 and music isn't fully integrated, not everybody has entrance music at this point, that one song, you think, oh, well, that's Ricky Steamboat. But they didn't yell out, oh, that's Ricky Steamboat's music, because there was no need to. You could just wait for the Techwood audience to react when they actually see him. And they're not particularly loud. This is not WMC in Memphis, where apparently they had like the greatest acoustics in the world for like making a crowd sound really loud. But it's a great moment as you're watching it on television. Now, what I will say is that Barry Windham and Ric Flair, they're beside themselves in the ring, as they say on commentary. But when it comes to Ricky Steamboat's surprise comebacks to WCW, Arn Anderson's facial expressions at Clash 17 when Dustin Rhodes brings Steamboat out as his partner is, I think, superior to what Flair and Windham are bringing to, and Dylan are bringing to the table right up front. But, well, yeah, the Arn Anderson one from that Clash is so great. So we're going to start with Steamboat. He's going to get out there right away opposite the United States champion Barry Windham. And you can argue that these two guys, that it's a meeting of the best wrestler in the world for 1988, Barry Windham, against the best wrestler in the world for 1989, Ricky Steamboat. Argument kind of falls apart when Steamboat leaves in July, but you could still make the case based on his body of work for the 6.5-7 months that he's there. He gets some arm drags, the classic Ricky Steamboat arm drags to start. He is flying all over the ring, Steamboat is. You could tell that this is a guy who's had about 10 months of rest. He's not working that WWF schedule where he's flying all over the country, just taking a beating on a nightly basis. And not only that, he's motivated as hell because, oh yeah, I'm going to come in and I'm going to be working with Ric Flair right away. He press slams Flair into Barry Windham. So we're establishing our story for this match early, which is Steamboat has got their number. It's not like Eddie Gilbert is, you know, coming in to help him out because he doesn't have to. Steamboat is able to handle these guys. As Gilbert said, he can beat these guys with both arms tied behind his back. Well, he's doing perfectly fine without any extremities tied anywhere. So Flair tags into the match formally. So now we get Flair and Steamboat. And let it begin! A shoulder block by Steamboat. And Flair kind of backs off. We get a chop exchange. But Steamboat, again, gains the advantage. He presses Flair again. He's like a one-man gang in there, the Dragon. And he can actually take that name because he's now known as Akeem on the other side of the world. So you can call yourself a one-man gang. The Horsemen just have no answers for anything that Steamboat is doing. He's just totally having his way with them, with everything they try to do. So Steamboat, because the Horsemen, you know, taking another powder again, he goes over to commentary and just wants to say a few words.
If you want to play, stay in the sandbox.
Look at the adjective, play.
If we didn't have a Kevin Nash at some point in time, for levity's sake, we would have had to invent him somewhere along the line. So Flair, he takes control in the corner, but only for a brief second because Ricky Steamboat going to fire up. He's taking on both of the Horsemen at the same time. He's got an answer for everything that they're doing. To put it in my terms, for like my 10-year-old brain, it's kind of like when you're playing Tecmo Bowl and the opponent keeps choosing the same play that you are, so they're just collapsing on you. That's pretty much what is happening with Ricky Steamboat against Flair and Wyndham. Because Eddie Gilbert, he doesn't even have to do anything. His job was done just recruiting Steamboat. All he has to do is stand on the apron and smile proudly. I really would like to know the nature of those talks between Eddie Gilbert and Ricky Steamboat, because you think of them, when were they ever in the same place at the same time? Like, does Eddie Gilbert have DiBiase-esque networking skills where was he able to get Steamboat's number through somebody else? I'd really like to know how this came to be. So you get a side headlock by Steamboat inside, but that now he finally does tag out to Eddie Gilbert, who apparently did not see eye to eye with Ric Flair. Flair being on the booking committee through 89 and into 1990, and then all of a sudden Eddie Gilbert disappears at a certain point in time because he has a chance to, you know, go elsewhere and be the full-time booker. He actually even controls on Flair here. Gilbert does with a head scissors, and then Flair flops in the corner, but then tags out to Wyndham. But honestly, with those two guys not getting along, Flair was not a particularly great booker, probably because I don't think he really wanted to do it. It was just something that was kind of thrust upon him. Whereas Eddie Gilbert, he was a wrestler, but as a creative mind, you almost think of him as that first before his career as a wrestler, whereas with Ric Flair, it's exactly the opposite. You get a slugfest with Wyndham and Gilbert, and counter of a side headlock by Gilbert, Wyndham with the back suplex. Eventually, Eddie ends up in peril, but like Steamboat, it's only very, very brief. He fires up. Flair is back in there. Irish whip cross corner, does the flip in the corner to the outside. Now the horsemen are regrouping for what feels like the 100th time in this match. And back inside, Gilbert hits a drop toe hold on Flair, and then immediately locks in the figure four. So even Eddie Gilbert has been sprinkled with the magic pixie dust of Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, where even he can do no wrong. But once Flair gets out of the hold, he goes for his own figure four. It's countered into an inside cradle, which gets a two count. But now Gilbert does end up in peril, which is what you would expect in a match like this. The horsemen are not just going to get dominated and railroaded for like 15 straight minutes. Barry Windham hits the Ted DiBiase power slam. Only 4 out of 10. It was a little too halting, in my opinion, in the delivery. Now, the formal in peril segment. But we do get plenty of hope spots with Eddie Gilbert, something that we saw at Clash of the Champions 4 when he's teaming with Ron Simmons against the Fantastics, and he's selling that shoulder injury like nobody's business. Eddie avoids a vertical suplex, gets it behind, and goes for the O'Connor roll. That gets two. He catches Flair with a clothesline, like going in those hope spots that I was talking about. But now Barry gets the tag from Rick and tosses Eddie to the outside, where Flair sends Gilbert's shoulder into the ring post, perhaps a callback to Clash 4, whether intentional or not. A great delayed vertical suplex by Barry Windham. Gets actually a pretty close two count. Follows it up with an atomic drop, but Eddie turns and clotheslines him. This is the Backlund-style atomic drop, and then Eddie just kind of turns and hits a desperation clothesline. But again, Windham is very close to the corner, so he's able to tag out to Flair, who now is going to go to school with a knee drop suplex. He hits a back suplex as well. I think he threw a butterfly suplex in there as well. I know Flair was working that in quite a bit in 89. Couple two counts. Barry Windham, it gets the big lariat, because of course he's from Texas. That actually gets the second of the two counts that I was referring to. Now, an inverted atomic drop and a slam by Wyndham on Gilbert, who is really in trouble here. And up top, Wyndham goes, that big 6'6 frame, goes for the flying elbow, where he kind of twists his body, almost Dr. D-esque. But that misses, and now we get the dual tags, because Wyndham is able to tag out to Flair, but on the other side, Gilbert tags out to Ricky Steamboat. So we got the two Ricks in there, and Steamboat's got complete control of everything Flair wants to do. Backdrops. He slams Flair's face into the mat, manages to fight off Barry Windham for good measure. And as you've seen, Steamboat just dominate these two guys, particularly Flair. Like, oh, he's definitely got Ric Flair's number. You have it in the back of your mind watching this, like, okay, is there going to be some sort of outside interference? Or is Steamboat actually going to be able to put this guy away and pin the world champion?
Powerful slam by the Dragon. Ricky Steamboat goes up top. The Dragon is preparing to fly here. High cross body up top, and he pins him in. Ricky Steamboat has just pinned the heavyweight champion of the world. The Dragon has returned to the NWA to pin perhaps the greatest champion of all time. Steamboat and Gilbert are victorious here.
I spoke about how this match told a great story of it. Steamboat having the number of Flair and Wyndham, and Flair and Wyndham's excuse would be, oh, well, we weren't ready because it was Mr. X we thought we were facing. We didn't think we were facing Ricky Steamboat. So they have that to fall back on. But it was a great match as it was put together as well, with the baby faces dominating up front. Eventually, Gilbert finds himself in trouble, as you would expect, and then you get the hot tag. Steamboat cleans house and eventually pins the world champion. However, some people still like to pick nits about this, which allows me to turn to the Wrestling Observer newsletter. And I pulled this from Scott Keith's Blog of Doom recaps, because I'm not an Observer subscriber. I don't need that kind of frustration in my life. So just a little bit on what went on here in this episode. Steamboat made his big return on the Saturday show as Eddie Gilbert's mystery partner, and it was pretty great. The original plan was for Steamboat to come out and wrestle under a mask and then unmask after getting the pin on Flair. But George Scott changed the plan. Okay, so I guess George Scott is there at that point. That was first in line of bad decisions on his part, actually. The mask thing would have been much more memorable. Flair is already giddy with excitement at getting to wrestle his favorite opponent again. Well, I can't argue with that last point, but I will argue with the mask thing being more memorable, because then you would have had a 15-minute match, or however long this went, where Ricky Steamboat is under a mask, and you can tell that it's him, and yeah, I guess there would be some suspense in waiting for it, but him just sort of walking up, I'm like, all right, I'm here, that plays in to them being so flustered. If they're just facing a masked guy, them being flustered doesn't make as much sense, because you're building off this history that Flair and Steamboat had from 84 and going all the way back to the late 70s. So I disagree with that sentiment. I think that the way that they did it was actually the correct call. Dave thinks that Flair Steamboat matches probably won't draw very well on pay-per-view, and that they'll pretty much have to have the match of the year to not be considered a disappointment. Well, thanks a lot, Dave. I mean, you certainly enjoyed sitting at ringside for Chi-Town Rumble next to Brad Muster, but for God's sakes, I mean, hey, can we just enjoy it for what it is? I mean, yeah, did it do the greatest business in the world? No, probably not, because there were some flaws with the angle going forward, such as, well, the aforementioned George Scott not wanting to promote the Clash 6 match, but other things such as where they go with the Ricky Steamboat part of things, where they really kind of turn him into Ned Flanders as sort of a non-religious version of like this family man, which is nice. I'm glad that Ricky Steamboat is a very nice guy. But when you're watching professional wrestling and the other guy is talking about how he's just banging broads and riding limousines and private jets, it's kind of like Flair's the guy we want to aspire to be, but, you know, we kind of settle for being, you know, Ricky Steamboat, having familiar sex with the wife and that sort of stuff. So it kind of made for a weird psychology going through this for the next couple of months. And it, in fact, kind of ended up turning Flair babyface as you get to the end of it. Then you get to the Wrestle War match. You know, he's certainly getting some, I don't know if you call them respect cheers, but maybe you could call it that. It's not like anybody was just going to out and out boo Steamboat like he was Roman Reigns back then. I think people just respected him too much. And thank God we never had to watch like the current wrestling environment with like Ricky Steamboat, because I don't want to live in a world where Ricky Steamboat gets booed by anybody. I mean, I'm sorry. That's just the way I feel about it. I don't know what it is with these shows. Even the AWA in 1987, this applies. That I fall in love with the bumper music on, like, the week that I'm doing the show. I like the little saxophone. It's really nice. It's maybe about, like, one step removed from becoming porno music, but it's not quite there. So Eddie and the Dragon, it sounds like an interesting team, Eddie and the Dragon, or it's Eddie and the Cruisers. But they're taking a well-deserved victory lap at the, well, not literally a lap, I mean, that's more Rick Steiner's thing. But they're celebrating their good fortune. And Eddie Gilbert, when you think about it, this is certainly his top moment in WCW and in the WWF between those two. Yeah, do you have higher highs maybe in the UWF and Memphis and elsewhere? Almost certainly, but on that big stage in the two major companies, this is his, I hate to say this because I'm not a huge college basketball guy, but it's his one shining moment.
Tony Schiavone, all the people, do you remember the movie, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance? Well, I got the man who beat the NWA World Heavyweight Champion on television. Welcome back to NWA, Ricky the Dragon Steamboat!
Yeah! I set out probably the longest campaign of my wrestling career. I've always had a quest in my life, and that was to be a world champion. I ventured all around the world, even with other different federations.
Right.
But I came back to my home, right here. Let's roll that film.
Yeah, let's take a look at it, Ricky.
It's a great story being told, but it's kind of ironic when you think about it, because he leaves the WWF at the exact moment that his former nemesis, the Macho Man, gets the title. A man that he had beaten for the Intercontinental title a year before. So taking it from a kayfabe perspective, he probably gave up his best chance to become a world champion, and then he thought, well, they're not going to book a face-versus-face match, and besides, I lost to Greg Valentine in the first round, and if I couldn't get past Valentine, how was I going to get past Savage in that same tournament? So he puts over Eddie Gilbert's tenacity as that fighting underdog that I was talking about earlier, as they're watching the video of the match, which is not really going to do a whole lot for me on this podcast. But they go back to Steamboat, and I guess kind of as they're watching it. And he kind of elaborates on this quest and why he said he came home. Of course, he was billed from Hawaii the whole WWF time because, well, that sounds a little bit better in Charlotte, North Carolina. God forbid Vince has this aversion to all things North Carolina because he grew up in, you know, some, you know, wrong side of the tracks there. And who knows that? You know what? I find it's best not to dig too deep with Vince McMahon's childhood. I know he did like that weird Playboy interview, but it's kind of like that Spinal Tap thing where they're like, when they're talking about one of the drummers like spontaneously combusting or whatever it was, best leave it unsolved. But so, okay, so the Dragon, he talks about why he's back.
Well, I'll tell you something right now. I've had some time off. I've had a little boy come into my life. He's been the thing of the last past year. But right now, he is that son of mine. One of the major reasons why I came back to the NWA, I want to secure his future. And to do that, I've got to win the World Heavyweight Championship.
And that little boy grew up to be Richie Steamboat. And now you know the rest of the story. He was born July 7th, 1987, so you extrapolate out the timing, he has to lose the Intercontinental title because he had asked for a little bit of time off. So it's a nice happy accident that you do get the Honky Tonk Man as an Intercontinental champion, going back to what I was saying earlier with Rotundo and, you know, are you able to main event house shows and all that business. So Steamboat is very, very family-oriented, which kind of hurts this angle with Flair a little bit, as I said, because Flair's the cool guy that everybody wants to be, and Ricky's just having familiar sex with Bonnie, who is maybe not a, well, let's put it this way, they're divorced now, so she might not have been the greatest thing for him. I'm sure all of Ricky's friends just hated her. I mean, I'm not going to go back and listen to, like, every podcast Flair ever did, but I bet Ric Flair hated her, like, most of all, because it meant that Ricky couldn't come out for a night on the town, even if just to be his wingman. Because I would imagine that Ricky Steamboat is probably one of the finest wingmen of all time. If even if he didn't drink, I feel like he would be good at it because he's pretty much just good at everything else. So let's put the family thing aside here because I am going to get an answer to a question that I asked earlier in the show where I was very curious about the nature of these talks between Eddie Gilbert and Ricky Steamboat for him to come in and be the tag team partner. But luckily, that's all laid out for me.
Once again, I'd like to thank the fans, the NWA fans, for the years of support that they still gave me when I was away from you guys. It's like coming home. It's like family.
Here,
okay,
Eddie,
go ahead.
I could have went out, and there's a lot of men that came up to me to be my partner when I was against Ric Flair and Barry Windham. There's a lot of people out there in wrestling I could have picked, but there's only one man in my mind that can beat Ric Flair, and that's Ricky Steamboat. And I'm very proud to have you a partner today. Thank you very much, Ricky.
Would have been funny if Jerry Lawler had called up Eddie Gilbert and said, let's let bygones be bygones. I want to screw the AWA by bringing the AWA World Heavyweight title onto NWA television. And then Gilbert just throws a fireball through the telephone line somehow. I don't know how it can be done. Only Eddie Gilbert and a few other Memphis dudes can throw fireballs through telephone lines. But yeah, so, okay, so Steamboat was ready to come back, and that seems to be the thing. So here are the losers. You think Flair and Wyndham and Dillon are just going to skulk off to the back? Of course not. They're pissed because they thought that they were facing Mr. X. Apparently, they thought Dangerous Danny Davis was going to be under a mask and wasn't expecting an unmasked Ricky Steamboat.
Now, wait just a minute.
Wait. What is this? You got no business here. None whatsoever. What do you think you're doing?
This is America. This is an equal opportunity country. I've made my negotiations with Crockett and Ted Turner, and I'm here, and
Mr.
I'm here.
Mr. X, what do you call that negotiation?
I'm here to stay.
This will never go down in the record book.
Hey, I've been listening to you talk for the last 10 years of how great every single one of your men are, and Mr. X shouldn't even have bothered you. Come on.
Mr. What are you should have bothered us? What should never take place? That should have never taken place. It was a scheme to keep us from preparing. We're not afraid of Ricky Steamboat. We didn't wrestle him. Just tell us his name so we can prepare for it.
We weren't prepared for this.
This will never go down in the record book. It'll never stand for sheer luck.
Now, in a situation like this, you would blame the agent. But in this case, it would be the manager, Dillon, for signing off on the entire thing. And I could have sworn that there was an angle where he was written off because the Horsemen didn't trust him anymore because of how this whole thing went down. And he sold the contracts to Hiro Matsuda, which is kind of an odd thing because I was watching Chi-Town Rumble earlier this week, and there's a Flair promo in the middle of it, and Hiro Matsuda is just standing there behind him, like, stone-faced and silent the entire time, because Flair really doesn't need a manager in that spot. It's just like what is he doing there? He's like the little Japanese man when the Yakuza has the fight with the local mob on The Simpsons. Like, he's just, come on, he's going to do something. But in any event, I mean, Flair, I mean, he's going to go nuts about this entire thing. As Meltzer said in The Observer, he's having a blast because now he gets to work with his favorite opponent. But for character's sake, he's very pissed off because Steamboat just kind of, he made a solid point there, like, hey, I negotiated with the people in charge. He said Crockett first, and then he kind of threw in Turner, realizing, oh, yeah, that's right. Crockett's nominally in charge, but it's really Ted Turner's company. Then he just, like, walks off. Like, he's done his work pretty badass by Ricky Steamboat, just leaving Flair there, holding the bag, and he's very upset about it.
Do you understand something? I'm a multi-millionaire, and this doesn't happen to millionaires. We don't walk out here. Our days are planned. They're scheduled. They're detailed. If I'm to wrestle Rick Steamboat, if he's to wrestle Steamboat, we know what an event. You shut up. Classy, as if the world were yours. I don't care if you got a kid and a wife. There's a wrestling. Don't walk out here milking the public
You're here for my belt, and you are gonna get it.
One thing I should mention, just based on the couple of weeks of TV that I watched leading up to this, I think it was 2 weeks before this, Flair does a promo where, yeah, he's dispatched Luger at Starrcade and was basically like, screw you, you're not getting any more title shots. So really, there's hardly any challengers to the throne, so he basically just thought that there was nothing that could touch him. So that's why, you know, he's so freaked out by this, just from a character perspective, because he thought that he was free and clear of everything, but he wasn't, and he was in for a big surprise. And what a way to kick off 1989 for the NWA. While it may not have done the greatest business in the world, damn, is it a freaking great year to go back and watch all the TV. Now, they've posted it on the award-winning WWE Network, but they inexplicably stop in the middle of July, which I don't understand why they do that. And it's been stuck there for like 3 or 4 years. Could you post the rest of 1989, please? Especially if you're going to be zapping YouTube accounts at the same time. Which, by the way, the account that had this episode got zapped earlier today as I record this on Wednesday. So I had put it on the playlist for the Greetings from Allentown YouTube playlist, which you should check out. I've been curating now 153 shows, but of course not all of them are there because the YouTube police have got to come in and, you know, do all their shit. And it really just kind of bugs me. As we roll credits once Flair is done with his angry rant, we do see that Jim Crockett is the executive producer, and we do not see George Scott's name, but that changeover takes place, you know, at some point in time. I just wish that there was a WCW like book that had like just the reference dates for this and had them be exact, but actually it's much more true to WCW's character that we just don't know shit. That stuff happened and we don't know why, it just sort of did, and everything is sort of haphazard at all times. But that's why we love WCW at the same time. And that'll do it for World Championship Wrestling, the Saturday edition for January 21st, 1989. Well, since we're mourning the loss of a couple of great and valuable YouTube accounts, you'll have plenty of time for podcasts this week, starting with the Our Vantage Point podcast with Joe Morata and Michael Quinn. This week, episode 162, they're looking at the influence of Billy Graham in wrestling, and there's a lot to discuss there, such as his influence on the broadcasting of wrestling, as in how not to actually broadcast wrestling from a color commentator perspective. And on the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing with Mike Crockett and Brian Malonis, Brian Fury is down in Florida on some sort of secret, very secretive assignment. The show started out with Crockett whispering very weirdly, which I can only imagine was Brian Malonis berating him for 36 consecutive minutes prior to the start of the show. I know Malonis is a sweetheart, but, you know, he can lay it in there every so often. But they do have on as their guest this week Ian Riccoboni of Ring of Honor, the voice of Ring of Honor Wrestling. And we learned that apparently Malonis came in to ROH at the exact same time as Ian became the lead announcer with Kevin Kelly's departure. I'm not sure. I guess I could look that up, but it took place after 2001, and I'm really no good at any of the wrestling after a certain point. It's like I did that 2012 show a couple of weeks ago. I don't think anybody listened to it because everybody looked and saw, oh, Saturday Morning Slam 2002? What the hell is going... 2012? What the hell is going on? Like, well, it was a good excuse for it, as I tried to say in the show, but I think a lot of people didn't hit the download button. I certainly appreciate if you do hit the subscribe button, because then it'll just automatically download to your podcatcher. You can save it for later and catch up at a certain point. That's greatly appreciated. You can also appreciate it. You can leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts /iTunes/ whatever the hell it is, or a review on any websites that are accepting as such. 5 stars is always appreciated. Do you know why? Because it provides... I thought the cat was about to say social proof, but apparently she's having trouble learning the English language. Can you roll over? Well, those words you do know. Anyway, 5 stars is always appreciated because it provides what is known as social proof that you are listening to and enjoying this podcast. I would have done a YouTube comment theater for this week, except for the fact that the video got zapped and I didn't screenshot the comments beforehand, which I sometimes do and I sometimes don't. However, because we have the Super Bowl on Sunday, and I'm just pathetic enough to do this because I've done it every single week of the regular season, all 17 weeks, and then all 3 weeks, stumbling through the playoffs to an inexplicable record of 1-9. It's Vinny Vegas Corner. I'm not sure why I'm still doing this, because I felt down, I felt despondent about losing 9 out of 10 to start the playoffs, but then I remembered my offhand remark last week saying that you should pick the AFC in the Pro Bowl, and they did cover the 1.5 points. The AFC did, 38-33, in a game that was largely forgotten with the news of Kobe Bryant's passing. But now we got the Super Bowl this Sunday, and it would be completely ridiculous if I just did not pick the game. I'm not going to do any of the crazy props, although I do enjoy the cross-sport ones, especially the screwed-up ones where it's like Yankees total wins in the 2020 season versus total touchdown yardage in the Super Bowl. And the touchdown yardage is favored by 1.5, and it's like you have to wait until like October for that to pay out because that's what baseball is going to run to. And I also like the Vegas playoff wins. This would be the Vegas Golden Knights plus 2.5 against total TDs in the Super Bowl because they pretty much just got to get to the second round, I think. And I like the Vegas Golden Knights. They're a pretty heavy team. Also, Sidney Crosby plus 0.5 against Jimmy Garoppolo touchdown passes. And Crosby's been on fire since he returned from an injury earlier this month. But okay, to the actual game itself, San Francisco and Kansas City. Everybody's calling it the Joe Montana / Steve DeBerg Bowl. Okay, they're calling it the Joe Montana Bowl. But when I see San Francisco versus Kansas City, my heart breaks because it reminds me, oh yes, that's right. In 2014, that was the World Series matchup between the first wild card in the AL and the second wild card in the NL, despite the fact that my Orioles won 96 games that year. I remember when they were good. That's how old I am. But not only that, but you have Jimmy Garoppolo, who has a chance to win his 3rd Super Bowl ring and pass both Manning brothers on the all-time list. Yes, he was a backup for the Patriots in 2014 and 2016, but it still counts somehow, some way. But Jimmy G, his career always seems to come back to Kansas City for whatever reason. His debut, 2014, Monday Night Football. Patriots are getting blown out 41-7 at the time. He comes in, goes 6-7 for 70 yards, throws a touchdown pass to Rob Gronkowski. Too little, too late. But it was down at the end zone that I was sitting at in Arrowhead Stadium when they set the all-time loudest crowd record or some such nonsense that night. Smash cut. 4 years later, he's starting for the San Francisco 49ers. There's great hope in the Bay Area that this quarterback is going to lead them to glory. And Jimmy G, running towards the sideline, for whatever reason, decides not to go out of bounds. He ends up tearing his ACL a half second later. He's out for the season. And the 49ers last year were very, very unlucky, which is why I thought that they were going to bounce back this year. Maybe not to this extent. Kansas City is favored by 1.5, and they absolutely deserve to be favored, given the way that they have put up points so far. And honestly, I have no idea where to go with this game. However, I do have a rule of thumb for Super Bowls, and it's not the offense, that good offense versus a good defense thing, which actually I think favors the 49ers in this one, because the good defenses tend to control the good offenses in this type of situation. What I'm talking about is the pocket passer versus the mobile quarterback. Patrick Mahomes has just been driving everybody crazy, running around with his escapability. However, Jimmy G, you'd have to call him more of a classic pocket passer. And as we go back through Super Bowls over the years, when you have a pocket passer versus the mobile quarterback, for some reason, it always seems to be that the pocket passer ends up prevailing. We haven't really had a mobile quarterback in more recent years. I don't consider Nick Foles to be in that vein because he was just in an Eagle system that was pretty much just absolutely perfect for his set of skills. 2015 season, Cam Newton against a pretty much immobile Peyton Manning. I think he was frozen in carbonite during the 2015 season. Anyway, Denver Broncos win in part because of their great defense. Super Bowl 47, 49ers in that one against the Baltimore Ravens. Joe Flacco, classic pocket passer versus Colin Kaepernick. Say whatever you want about him now. Great mobile quarterback at that time. And you go back further, and I don't know. I'm just thinking more recent history. So I'm just kind of, I'm not sure where to go in this game. Well, we'd like to see Andy Reid finally get his Super Bowl ring after being a coach, damn good coach in the NFL for over two decades now. For some reason, there's something about this Chiefs team and the way that they've been getting out to slow starts, and they've been able to recover. But I think that this time, if they fall behind by 10 or 14 points, I do think that they'll be able to catch up. But I think that the 49ers are much more able to withstand it than the opponents that the Chiefs have played. They've played the Houston Texans and the Tennessee Titans. And yes, while the Titans beat the Ravens and the Patriots, I don't think that they are of like the highest caliber team that you could have faced. Whereas the 49ers blew out the Vikings and then pretty much dismantled Green Bay until Green Bay kind of, you know, made a little bit of a run in the second half, but didn't threaten too much. So I'm gonna take the point and a half in this one and say that it's gonna be like the 2014 World Series all over again. It's gonna come right down to the wire, but San Francisco is going to end up pulling it out 31-24. So look for the over in that one. For whatever reason, people might blame Andy Reid at the end for screwing up the clock. Who knows? But I'm hoping it'll be a good Super Bowl, because I just want to remind you people that, with the exception, I guess, of last year, because, you know, there was not much scoring, the New England Patriots, hate them all you want, they play entertaining Super Bowls, and I don't want to hear any dissent on that topic. And hopefully I'll just end up going 2-9 on the playoffs for Vinny Vegas Corner. Now, for next week's show, I'm going to step away from YouTube and go into the reserves for something that I've wanted to do for quite a while because of one guy who is on this show. Actually, two different guys, now that I think about it, on this show. It is one of the last consequential episodes of WWF Superstars from July 20th, 1996. Now, later in the year, you have Austin and the whole Pillman angle where he Pillmanizes his ankle. Not unlike what we saw with Edge and Randy Orton earlier this week on Raw. But on this show, we have an interesting matchup of Mark Marrow against Hunter Hearst Helmsley. This would be during Hunter's quote-unquote punishment period of 1996. How much of a punishment was it, and was it really that bad? I'll take a look at that. We're also going to see Camp Cornette in a six-man, Vader, Davey Boy Smith, the British Bulldog, and Owen Hart. And also the Goon is in action. And that's the guy that I've wanted to get to for so very long. Hockey is back after the NHL is back after the All-Star break. I actually went to a Boston University hockey game over the weekend, and it ended in a tie. And I loved it because the earth did not collapse on itself. You can actually have tie games. But one other guy is on this show by the name of Stone Cold Steve Austin. And he's in action, or is he in action? Because he's got a thing going on where, well, he's a little bit off kilter compared to the rest of the roster. He had just won the King of the Ring a little over a month before this, and things are going a little bit slowly for him, and I'll explore that topic on next week's show, episode 154. Again, thank you so much for listening, and tune in then next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
The only time I've ever gone into a bar and seen guys with makeup on their faces when I took a wrong turn and went to the wrong bar.